Hello and welcome. In this episode, we learn how Dennis started building the most efficient and affordable Hyperloop solutions out of Menlo Park, California, winning multiple awards. Listen why he decided to start the Swissport company after having a chat with Elon Musk himself. Find out how he skipped his master's, jumping directly to his PhD studies at the prestigious École Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne. What he learned after living in United States, Romania, and Switzerland, and what it takes to run a tech company at a such young age. Enjoy. Hello, Dennis. Thanks so much for joining my podcast. So it's going to be great to start off by giving the listeners a short summary of your bio.
Thanks a lot for the invitation, Stefan, and I think this is really nice from you. And I'm glad I'm here in this podcast. I don't know, when I'm asked about a summary or a bio or something like that, I don't know how to tell it. But I will try to chronologically explain some events of my life, maybe. So I'm actually born in southeast of Romania in a town called Mangalia. I graduated the high school in Mangalia, and afterwards I went to university in Bucharest. I graduated the Faculty of Electronics and Telecommunications in Bucharest at Polytechnic University of Bucharest, and then I moved for a while in US. I worked there to create some Hyperloop capsules that were launched in Los Angeles, and then I moved for a PhD in Switzerland, where I also have the Swissport, the startup. So the startup is a spin-off of my let's say participations in the Elon Musk competition about Hyperloop.
Right, great Dennis. So congrats on the things you've done so far. Let's start all the way back. I'm gonna start with Politehnica University of Bucharest. I know I graduated the same university. I mean, it's quite a tough school. It's one of the best in Bucharest. Tell me a little bit about how did you approach your studies, because the entire story of Swissport, I think, started off while being a student. How did you tackle school? I mean, most of my guests, we discuss about internships, we discuss about NGOs, we discuss maybe about starting companies while being a student. And of course, you match the same pattern. I mean, you had quite a nice stint during your university. And let's start all the way back.
Yeah. So actually, I finished my first semester in the university with 100%, so I marked 10 out of 10 at every class that I took at that moment, and I had kind of an ambition after that semester. I think the first semester in that university is one of the toughest, and then I said, okay, if I manage to score 10 out of 10 at all the classes, why not to continue this way? So I kind of put a lot of pressure on my shoulders when it came to the exams. So I was not the most relaxed when it came to kind of try to get the maximum score at every exam. But yeah, I actually graduated valedictorian. And I mean, I have also to admit that there have been many exams where I was a bit frustrated. For instance, probably I'm one of the only valedictorians who didn't manage to pass once an exam. So I had, I failed one of the exams, but then I went in the fall to, and this is not a nice story that I have, a nice memory I have about the university I graduated from, but I think it needs to be spoken. So yeah, I went to an exam, and the professor I was having the exam with was also the vice president of the university, of the Senate of the university. And probably you also had him at your, I remember that he was also teaching to your series. It was about microprocessors or microcontrollers or something like that. And I was just coming from the competition from LA, winning that competition. He said, oh, you can come with your note for the exam. And I was one of the students that was doing like never. And of course, I came with some notes that I took from a colleague. And then he saw that, and he came to me And he said, yeah, you should be out now from the exam. And I said, why? And he said that because you have notes. I said, everyone has notes. I just stopped because it was impossible. And I think it was the only 8 out of 10 that I took in that school. And by the way, coming here, linking this with the internship, I was working to program processors, microcontrollers, in one of the best companies in that domain in microchip as an intern after the first year of my studies. So it was a bit frustrating that it was my specialization and this is what I know to do at the basis, so software embedded. And I scored the minimum at that class. So it was a bit weird, I have to admit that. But yeah, nevertheless, I think also there are professors that I don't know. They really understood that at that moment that it's really important for my future. So I have good and bad stories. So I, as I told you, I was doing an internship, I think, after my first year and a half or something like that of my university at Microchip. So it was really difficult to get that internship, but then it was really great. And then I left in the summer. So when I had to do my internship in the industry officially, I left in US to work for the capsule. We manufactured the capsule in United States, and then I came back for a while, then I moved back. I had some troubles because I was not attending a lot of classes and a lot of laboratory sessions in the last year of my university, but at the end I managed somehow to, you know.
So then, sorry, I'm gonna jump in. So first of all, yeah, you mentioned this internship, and it's not quite common to do an internship after your first year. Why did you do that? Why did you decide to do an internship right after your first year of engineering school? Because it's not common. And I think it was difficult for you to get the offer, as companies might say, you know what, you're too young. Did you have colleagues who were doing the same thing?
No, I haven't actually. It was difficult, but I was passionate about what I was doing at that moment. And I'm also passionate now. I also had the chance because I think I managed to win a prize at one of the scientific competitions, you know, at the end of the second semester. It's called, I forgot the name.
Ah, right. I think
it's like, there's kind of a scientific.
Yeah.
And I managed to win a prize. So then I kind of met a person. Then that person facilitated me an interview. And then I got it. I have to admit that I competed with some people that were finishing the third year of bachelor at that time, but I managed to get it. So it was really good. And I had a chance. That company, they had the lab where they let me work in, and, you know, was really something else for me. But I also left, you know, and I also have a story with my leaving. I kind of knew on a Friday that I have to go to US, and on Friday evening, I said I have to resign. And they said, no, you cannot. And I said, okay, I can. And then I went to the director of the company. I said, okay, because I explained to her that on Monday, I was actually having my ticket to go to US. So I bought a ticket right after I knew that I would go to US. And then I resigned. I packed everything and I left. You know, it was like really in one weekend. It was really interesting. It was really interesting. And I managed to learn a lot. I also had a lot of, I kind of have a place to work at, and I was free. They were kind of paying me part-time or something like that, but I didn't have specific tasks, which was really great because I was doing my projects. So I was using their microcontrollers to develop different types of projects, which was really great because, yeah, I think we don't have that many chances in that university when it comes to infrastructures or laboratories or people that are open to help you in general. So yeah, I mean, it was a chance, let's say.
Okay, right. So now that you've been mentioning the competition in the States, so how did it start it off? I've been listening some interviews you had before, and you've mentioning this Reddit group, and it reminds me somehow of this Wall Street Bets. I mean, many things are starting off just from a Reddit group nowadays.
It was really a chance. I have to admit that. I was in that company and I was scrolling on Reddit, and then I saw a person that today is one of my best friends in US, Richard, who said, hey, who wants to create a Reddit group team? So Elon Musk was launching a competition about Hyperloop at that moment. I think it was 2015. He was saying that, look, I'm going to come with 1 mile of infrastructure. You have to build a one capsule solution that will fit this infrastructure. There have been many universities coming along for that competition. There have been many great teams that participated, even MIT, Stanford, Berkeley, Munich University, Delft University, they managed to create a team, and we're competing with those people, but we're a bunch of people from every part of every corner of this planet. And we met for the first time on that Reddit post, but we met, we qualified in the final 100 teams at that competition, and we managed to win that competition to get the Best Design Award. It was really great. And I remember that also the party was great. And then I came back in Romania because it was January and I had to pass my exams. Yeah, that part was not really great. After that, I worked for a while being in Bucharest. We actually got a successful campaign on Indiegogo, where we managed to fundraise the money we needed in order to build a capsule we promised. And then I moved in June in US, and then we built that capsule. We're living together in an Airbnb house, and was one of my greatest period of my life. And in January 2017, we brought the capsule from Silicon Valley to LA in order to fit our capsule to that infrastructure. So yeah, I mean, this is how we actually started.
All right, Dennis. So you had a good run with this competition. And for me, what's interesting, so you had colleagues from all over the place. It was like natural to be able to work with so many different nationalities. I mean, people with different cultures. All the time you've been chatting on Reddit, or of course you've been using any other tool. But the first time you've met in person was in
Slack.
In Slack. You've met, I mean, you were basically doing like any other type of work everyone is doing in a company, but you are just a student, which I think it's quite nice.
I think as long as you're honest, transparent, you know, to, you know, keep a decent way of talking, I think nothing bad can happen. People don't judge a lack of knowledge as long as you show that you're open, you show that you have interest in to build something. Yeah, I think it was not a problem. I even went kind of, I was like one of the youngest in the team, and I kind of felt that the others were better than me, or people working in different companies around Silicon Valley. But yeah, I mean, in less than 3 months, I became the control lead. So I worked on the software embedded, that class that I was not capable to pass at the right moment. I managed to create this, what I also presented at my bachelor degree. So I presented an algorithm that was controlling the levitation and propulsion in a stable way. Yeah, that's another story, because yeah, I mean, they didn't understand many things. And he asked me at the end of the presentation, ah, so I see that you have a vacuum tube there. You know, so yeah, it was a bit weird, but I think I graduated with almost 10 out of 10 or something like that. They just saw that the grades, and then they didn't ask much.
All right, right. So let's leave the school. Tell me a little bit more about how was it like to spend all this time in California, in the States, working with your team. You mentioned you were already a lead in a project. You've won so many awards already. I'm sure it was not easy at all.
Yeah, it was not really easy. And I think the timeline was something super tight. We managed to build one capsule in less than 6 months. And this was not something very usual, let's say. But we're also having fun. And we kind of had a good program, a good schedule, because we're working a lot during the week, but then Friday evenings and Saturdays we're having free time, and we're having a lot of fun in San Francisco, and having our Airbnb house. We're starting to also, we're having parties in that house, but then on Sunday we're starting again. On Sunday evening we're starting again the week, and I think was really cool, and people were so relaxed, and so because everything look at this project kind of in a passionate way, and was not kind of any interest in between us. We were just pulling in the same direction. So it was really great. I have to admit that was one of the greatest times I had in my life. Yeah, I also had different friends around West Coast, and we're having a lot of fun. So more than work. So it was also work, but more than that, we also had fun. I remember that I also skydived once above San Francisco. I promised myself that I'll never do that again, but it was kind of some, I think that's that's something we had a lot of activities around. And also I met a lot of nice Romanians working at Facebook, also partied once at Facebook. It was also Mark Zuckerberg there. It was really cool. Yeah.
Right. I'm curious. So you've mentioned this Indiegogo crowdfunding. How did you go around that? The idea was coming from after being in the States, or it's not common being a student in Bucharest, especially an engineering student, and coming up with these ideas. Okay, let's do a crowdfunding campaign on Indiegogo or any other platform. Was something that you've seen in Silicon Valley, or how did you go around that?
Actually, aside of the academia activities that I was doing for the university, everything that I've done so far in my professional life, which really mattered, was done on an off time, somehow on something that was not kind of related to university. For instance, I'm in the last year of my PhD, where I study deep math applied to, I create complex mathematical models for the Hyperloop transportation. I've never studied such a thing in the university. What I want to say is everything that worked out in my life was out of the university itself. I was also I was trying to understand and to learn more about the way we're kind of put in front of a problem at this technical school. And I also had a person that helped me a lot during the studies, a person who is actually also my friend today. He also had a business during the university. He was a PhD in that school, but he was really cool. He was kind of an entrepreneur, and he also showed me different ways of, and this helps me a lot today. I think this idea that you mentioned, I heard it from this person, and then what we did was really to market different cool subsystem we had on the capsule to the public. So what we're giving back, we're selling celebrity, and we're selling, let's say, kind of subsystem. So I'll give you an example. The fixed ideas, I'll give you an example. So we're selling, let's say, we had 8 hover engines for the first prototype. And if you're like donating or buying, let's say, 1,000, if you're donating $1,000, you're capable to, you're allowed to name the engine. So there have been people that donated or bought flight jackets. So we also had kind of some flight jackets, like the astronauts. And then we're having a mission patch with our capsule. And then we're selling that, the jackets with, I don't know, $500, and we're manufacturing the jackets with $10 in China. So this is the way actually we managed to fundraise. Now, by the way, you should buy your SwissPod t-shirt. So we have new t-shirts on the website.
I went to the website, but of course it's gonna be dropped off in more than 2 months, I think. And I just let it fly. I mean, I'm gonna buy it. I'm gonna buy it.
It's gonna be in less than 1 week. But to make sure that we're not. We're not. I mean, on Tuesday I'll have the t-shirts in Switzerland. So then it will take probably one more week. But I just wanted. What I want to do is that if we run out of stock, we'll not have to, you know, to hurry to build new t-shirts, because we are not
you're building technology.
We're not Gucci or
exactly. It depends. I mean, for a particular audience, it's better than Gucci, you know, having a t-shirt from SwissPod.
But hey, you can also instantly buy the name on the pod, but that costs you 10 times more, I think.
Okay, I see what you mean. I mean, I think you're not just an engineer. I mean, you find problems and try to solve them. But yeah, I think it's a mix of engineering and business. This is what you were trying to say. Like, you've done things outside of university, like with SwissPod, which this is my next question. So you've been winning, and only after that you started the company. How did you come with the idea of starting a company out of this contest, out of this experience you've had in Silicon Valley?
I actually had a conversation with Elon Musk in the 2018 summer.
It's okay, sure. Having a conversation with Elon Musk. Yeah.
Actually, he remembered my face, and he recognized me because at the second competition, I think he came on my back and said like that, just stick my back. And then I said, "Hey, I'm Elon." I said, "Hey, I'm Dennis. Nice to meet you." And you know, we're kind of meeting, we're testing a capsule. But then he saw me again in the Swiss company team that I created here in Switzerland at the university. I was kind of lucky because we had a 40 minutes meeting, and we discussed about the future of transportation, the way specifically how Hyper should look like in order to have a feasible system. And of course, everything at a very high level, you know, kind of philosophical way. But then that was kind of a food for thought for me. Was summer 2018. Then I think in 2019, in March, March, 18th of March, I think is the date of incorporation. We incorporated SwissPod, of course, with our co-founder, that is also the CTO of the company. I think we started at the end of 2019. We started the real operations in SwissPod. It was kind of my ambition to continue in this industry. Also, I continued it probably in another 1 year from now on for my PhD. I really want to see this product working. And I think that we have one of the most affordable solutions when it comes to price and efficiency. So I think it was kind of my personal ambition to get this thing real in a way.
So what do you think? It's going to be real or not?
I think it's going to be real, if you ask me. I think the real question is when it's going to be.
Of course.
And here I don't have an answer to give, but now we build the first testing facility in Europe, which is what I think this is the first time when I mentioned, and I think it's publicly. I hope this podcast will go public.
Say it again.
And we release those and we also prepare something huge in US. So I think there is much more to work on the technology itself yet before going to the market, because what can happen is that you end up in a situation as Maglev did in the past. So you create kind of an affordable infrastructure that is not competitive with something that it's already been built, such as railway or highways or airports. Therefore, there is a huge risk on that. And we have to admit, and we have to see the reality that those decisions in general in a real democracy are taken by governments that they work on infrastructure. So the governors in general are politicians. We have to see the reality that maybe the only personal scope of a politician is to be re-elected at the next election. So having such a risky project, investing 10 billions in 4 years in such a project probably is not worth it because the technology is not yet proven. So I think before really going in a hypercapsules, we need to spend some years more on testing the technology of hyper. If you ask me an estimate, 10, 15 years might be a good start for hyper.
Right. And so just to follow up on this, so do you think, are you in the right place? I mean, is it Europe or Switzerland a good place, or would be better place Silicon Valley or, I don't know, Japan? Or
I mean, if you ask me about founding or roots or what are you exactly
thinking? I mean, in terms of mentality, in terms of governments being having an open mind towards this kind of innovation and being committed into...
I was tempted now to give you an answer to say that US might be a good place to be, but
they don't have trains.
I have to remember that. I have to remember that we also were granted by the Swiss government now. So I, as far as I know, it's the first public investment or the first public grant in a hyper company. So even if I was tempted to say it's US, I don't know what to say.
For example, in France, we have the TGV, but I know in the States, when it comes to trains, they are not that far away. I mean, when it comes to the train infrastructure. So yeah, I don't know. For example, I had regarding this question, if you think you are in the good market, I mean, in the good timing, the good position. I had, for example, Alexander on the previous episode on my podcast, and we were talking about this issue because, I mean, he had many startups. I mean, he's just 24 years old, and he already had a few startups along the way. And he traveled to Silicon Valley and so on. And he had two times already, he met like two challenges. One, which is the timing. He got this feedback from not yet customers, but from the people, from the target audience, that the timing is not right. And the second challenge, the position was not right. Him being based out of Bucharest. For example, if he would have been based in London, of course, maybe the challenge would, I mean, there would have been no challenge after all if he would have been in London. So how important do you think being in the right location matter for your company? And of course, the timing. I think innovation doesn't, in your case, it's not about the customers. I think it's more deeper than that. So I don't think this question applies. I think the only question remains.
Timing is not only an input parameter, but it can also be an output parameter of your technology. I wouldn't rely on saying that timing be good or might not be bad. Also the place, I think location, I don't know what to say. I think if it comes to the development of the technology, I think Switzerland or US are good places to be. But maybe if it comes to a real Hyperloop application, a real Hyperloop case, it might be that country that has not many layers and not many institutions to give a decision about building such an infrastructure might be a better case. I'm referring here to especially the countries in the Middle East and in Asia that are not the most democratic countries, but it can facilitate the construction and the manufacturing of such an infrastructure. It takes you probably less time to go on the market in such places, but you never know. And I think also, if you ask me, a real answer would be that I think location does not really matter. As long as you prove that your technology, it does not represent a risk in this decision process. Yeah, I think it does not really matter. I don't want to find any, in case I will fail, I don't want to find any excuse in saying that location was good or timing was not good. I don't know, secret service was conspiracy or, you know, this kind of thing. So I don't want to get this kind of, I think, I can control everything I have in my company. And if I do wrong, it will happen wrong. If I do fine, probably it's going to be fine. Of course, it's also a matter of luck somewhere. You know, you also need a bit of luck. I wouldn't totally rely on timing or location. So, yeah.
I would say you're after the Swiss precision. This is why you're based in Switzerland. But okay, so so you're based out of Switzerland. Tell me a little bit more about your PhD. I know I'm a bit out of all over the place here. So you've answered the question: how did you started? Why did you started a company out of just competition, an engineering competition? You've mentioned in Elon Musk, the discussion with Elon Musk, and eventually you had the courage to just take this role. I'm going to start a company. It was you and your friend. And then how did you move to Switzerland, for example? Because it was a PhD, right? But why did you choose to do the PhD in Switzerland in the first place? In fact, when did you take the decision? You were in California, in the States, right?
And was by chance. Well, yeah, was a bad luck. Or a good luck, whatever you want to call it. I just took it. So I was admitted for one of the most prestigious US company for a PhD, but I haven't had the time to provide a good result on a TOEFL exam. I think I managed to score 85 or something like that. And at that university, they were having a tight constraint between 95 and 100. And therefore I failed. And then I said, okay, I'm not going to spend my time on learning how to take 95 at this exam. It was, I don't know, if I don't like something, I'll never do that. So yeah, I just said, okay, let's go on the other side. So I applied for a master program in Switzerland. So I arrived here in Switzerland for a master program, but I didn't graduate the master. So after 2 or 3 weeks, I got admitted for a PhD. So
you skipped
I also jumped into a PhD. Yes.
Which again is not easy. I mean, how it was because of your results? I mean, your astonishing results?
I had a strong application. And also I graduated 4 years of bachelor, as you know, in Romania, plus an internship during the summer, which is considered here a bachelor plus a master, because the bachelor is around 3 years. And the master around 1 year and a half or something like that. So I had the European credits necessary to enter the PhD or something like that. But I also then they also told me that I had a strong application. One professor from one of the lab, he wanted me specifically. So in general, if somebody wants you as a professorship level, it's you get it. So. Well, that was the strongest point of the application. Somebody wanted from you from the interior. So yeah, this is how it happened.
Right. And how was it like being a PhD student in Switzerland?
I'm part of the energy sector of EPFL, which is top three in the world, or top four now, or something like, let's say top five, I don't know. Like, there, you know, it's always, we're second at the point. Then we became the fourth, and then, you know, it's always a big competition that, and there is a lot of pressure, especially in our domain with our professor, because he's not kind of a professor who publishes in conferences and publishes as much as he can, but he wants to publish only journal papers. And the journal papers in general, I don't know, I just submitted one of 45 pages. So it's kind of, you write not a book about something, but half of a book, let's say. And it's pretty tough, and there is a lot of pressure on that. But in the same time, this school has a very good attitude about entrepreneurship. So it's kind of imitating, let's say, the attitude of Stanford. So it's an environment in the school where there is, for instance, a special department called Technology Transfer Office, where you can bring the IP you developed during your academia into a company. And this is super cool. And this is there are two polytechnic universities in Switzerland, ETHZ, the Zurich University, and EPFL Lausanne, and they compete. But ETHZ, it's kind of a classic university where people are really tough, really old style, while the one in Lausanne here, there are great people, great attitudes, like really looking for innovations, really looking for startups, to create new startups, to create new opportunities. So I don't know if you know, but I think it's the French part of Switzerland, it's only 22 or 23%, while the German part is around 70%. But even that, like more than 60% of the investments in the startups. So it's really important to highlight this because these universities let you also prepare yourself during the university studies to go on the market as soon as possible. And this was really cool because this also we applied for this fund at the Swiss government with this consortium between universities, private companies, and I think it's a good place to be if you want to launch a startup.
Sorry, Denis. So about investments. Really, sorry, I think I've lost you for a few seconds when you were talking about the investment side.
More than 60% of the investments that are happening in tech startups or biotech startups, let's say, are happening in this region, in this environment here, in the university. There is also kind of an innovation park where those startups are placed in nearby EPF and nearby the school. So it's really something comparable
right.
with what's happening at Stanford.
Right, right. So I think I wanted to ask, because currently you are the CEO of the company and you are doing you're an engineer doing the PhD, and running a company takes a different muscle. It's one thing to be an engineer. It's a completely another thing being a CEO. How was it like? I mean, how did you pick up the skills when it comes to sales, marketing, business in general? How did you go about
that? I've learned. I think that's the most important. I didn't know many things at the beginning, but I also had bright people nearby me, and I learned a lot. I think I've been kind of growing up in three different, environments. So one of them was Romania, one of them was Switzerland, and one of them was US. In Romania, I learned, not mandatory in the university, but I learned a lot of science, a lot of critical thinking. Then in US, I learned a lot of business, a lot of marketing. Then in Switzerland, what I learned is to kind of have a lot of rigorosity on doing things and a lot of, you know, to kind of try to, I learned kind of some moral values such as maybe transparency, honesty, how to value the potentials I had in, learned in Romania, let's say. So I think this is something very different. Now, if you ask me with Romania, I think there are clear paths how you can value your potential more than creating your critical thinking. It's very important to also have that skill, but I think more important is to go a step forward on that. So I was open, and when you are open, in general, things are happening. Yeah, I mean, I also was lucky here in Swissport, because I have a really great team that helps me a lot. There are a lot of team members that have much more experience than me. There are people at 70 years old in my company. There is a lady at 55 years old, and my mother is 54. So, congrats. There are a lot of mature people in the company where I can learn from. And I think this brought me in a position to understand more about people and to understand more about, let's say, non-technical skills.
For you, I think it's coming easy being a CEO, because I mean you have the faith, you have the mind. I mean, being having top grades in engineering school, doing your PhD, it's the right faith to have on a such company, like in this field, in disrupting the transportation and so on. I mean, it's the right figure. But what's your piece of advice for students being in an engineering school, for example? What should they do in order to step out a bit of the comfort zone of engineering and just trying a bit to scale the skills when it comes to, for example, marketing, but marketing themselves? For example, if they want to apply for a job. what's your piece of advice you would have to give to?
I think I'm not in a position to teach someone how to do that, but I can say what I did, and maybe they can try and experiment in their life. I think being open to learn, I think it's more important, more than your ego itself. Also, in the same time, in different parts of the world, people are kind of feel guilty if they don't have a knowledge to do something. But I think that's not important. I think knowledge is not that important. While to be an open person, to have a capacity to adapt to new situations, for me, this is the right definition for intelligence, capacity to adapt for new situations or to adapt for new kind of environments, which is kind of exiting the comfort zone.
Right.
And I think more also important is to try to tackle the interactions you have with people. Not, again, not really about the knowledge. I think knowledge, you can get a lot of knowledge, but I think imagination of to be open, to adapt to new situations, to be interactive. I think this puts you in a better position than any kind of person that has knowledge, but he doesn't have any other skills. So that's why I was saying that here I kind of managed maybe to value more my potential that I had. I think that's more important. And I think also comfort zone sometimes is not bad. But it's bad if you stay much, in that comfort zone.
Mature enough. Well, you step...
Maybe a comfort zone, I think it might be for someone to do not be in a comfort zone. So a comfort zone, it's paradoxical, but it can be like a comfort zone for me. Maybe it's to work, right? For instance, I'm really kind of not comfortable if I leave my monitor, if I leave my laptop, if I leave what I do, what I work. So you see, there is kind of weird that maybe a comfort zone, if I go to fun, for instance, to have fun, I don't know, I go to play tennis, trying to get a bit of comfort zone might not be a comfort zone, might be a more non-comfort zone. So it's very weird. So I think it's kind of, so that's why I was saying that maybe it's not mandatory to be in a comfort zone, but it's bad if you stay much in that comfort zone.
It depends. I mean, for you, maybe it's gonna be easier to finish a PhD at a top school in in Switzerland, I mean, in worldwide, than, I don't know, living, doing a playing a tennis match for half an hour. All right.
It depends. It depends on what you want in your life. But yeah, it's also a trap. It's a very long discussion here.
All right, I like it. So for you, so you've been to, you grew up in Romania, you, even in Romania, you've changed places from closer to Constanza, then to Bucharest, then to United States, then to now we're in Switzerland. You've changed places. Clearly you have this adaptability. And I like when you mentioned, for example, that your internship after the first year of engineering school, I mean, you really have a passion for engineering. That's clear. And this is that led you being in this position of being a CEO of such a high-end field and disruptive. Now, for example, I've seen so many talks you had, so many TED Talks, for example, which again is not easy, and you've mentioned having the right people around you to guide you and give you some support and advice with skills that you might not have at the moment. For example, a TED Talk, I'm sure you probably had friends that helped you in order to prepare for giving a TED Talk. So how important do you think is having this network around you with like great people to support you?
I think it's really important. I had three people helping me at my last TED Talk. One person was rewriting my talk. One person who was helping me to control my not proper movements, let's say, of my body, and one person who was helping me to dress. Just to give you an example, the person who helped me to reiterate my text. In general, when I go somewhere to present something, I don't have my text, I don't have slides, I don't have a prepared text, but for my last TEDx, I had prepared something. Wasn't really comfortable. I don't like that, but yeah, I kind of understood I had to. And the person who change my text with a friend, for instance. And then he told me, like, dude, it's like reading your text here is like I hear a speech from Greta screaming at us that we pollute, you know, too much, and so you have to be more friendly. And then, you know, I was completely kind of like, okay, I have to change. And then he changed all my texts, and then he kind of created a nice story about that. And then I don't know, probably 99% of what I said in that TEDx was true, but maybe 1% was just to complete a story, let's say. Right. Something that I was not really comfortable with, because I knew that that was not real, and I tried to play it as much as I can, that role, you know. But yeah, I mean, it was really important, I think, to understand that you are not good enough at everything in your life, and it's better sometimes to listen. I think listen is a sign of a leader. I mean, many of the leaders in the history of this humanity, they are listening more than talking. The real leaders, I think listening, it's a good sign. I like people that talk less and listen more.
Mature, that's mature. You want to anticipate another question of mine. So running such a nice company, doing so many great things, and yet when it comes to giving a TED talk, which again is not easy at all, you acknowledged, I need help. And for some people, this might not come very easy, admitting that, okay, I'm not easy on giving a talk. I'm not giving a, of course, it's not any other talk. It's the TED talk, which changes a bit things. But it's mature. It's very mature to admit this and bring in another people, bring another friend, which is better on that particular subject to give feedback. That's mature.
I think in the same time it's good to filter that, and it's good to kind of not lose your every person has his own charisma, and that charisma is based on a mix of your thoughts, of your feelings, with how you output that on your body, and I think in the same time it's good to keep your way to talk, let's say. Even if you know that the text was 80% built by another person, I think with small changes, with small, you know, interventions in the text, I think you should keep also the way you talk in general. And I think it's important to be natural. I pitched, I think, one month ago, it was kind of a competition or something like that, in this university that I was explaining to you that it's a good environment in. And I had a prompter, you know, to read the text, because you don't want to pitch for 2 minutes. And then I think I did 3-4 reiterations, because it was super observable that if you read, you don't mean that much. It's right. Like presenting news. You just right. Objectively present news. And then, you know, I observed that this can happen also if you do it in this way in TED Talks, like if you accept all the changes in the industry. So I think there is a thin line between keeping your natural attitude, but also improving your speech from exterior. So yeah, it's... So,
yeah, you have...
I think all the life, it's an optimization problem.
the engineer is talking. Yeah, you have to make it your own, I guess. I mean, without being genuine, people can see that. All right, so do we include, for example, mentors as well in this category of having a network around you? How, for example, when you were in the States, did you have any like mentor to maybe it's in a mask, I don't know. asking for help. Of course, it's not like a formal, yeah, it can be an informal mentor. It's kind of, it can be like a model, like a role model, any type of person you might have. Maybe it's Elon Musk.
I have to admit, I was educated in his university, let's say. Being in that competition involves you in a project that it's really tough. maybe not in a direct way, but in an indirect way with SpaceX. I think we graduated, all of us, we participated during these years in that competition. I think we graduated at school. We can admit that. But I would not really highlight Elon Musk on this equation more than their top engineers. So I think we also had a lot of experience and a lot of exchange. More than being a mentor, it was a kind of a bidirectional collaboration we had with SpaceX, because they also learned a lot about our technologies. And even if they were working at SpaceX, maybe they're missing some technical knowledge. But again, it's important, not the knowledge is important, while the attitude. So I would say this interaction with SpaceX made me to think in a different way. And also, I think here in Switzerland, my PhD supervisor is a really great person, and sometimes he drives me crazy. But at the end, you can understand some things that he says. And yeah, I mean, there have been many people in my life that helped me a lot, either with advices or with discussions or with investments or with I've been really lucky when it came to this interaction. So always when I needed someone at a point, he or she showed up at the right moment. I think it's also important to mention that. So I think it's not only one person that helped me or it was my mentor, let's say, but I think there are maybe, and yeah, I think, I don't know, if you ask me one of the first, I think I can also mention the professor I worked with during my high school period for physics or mathematics, that both of them, they were kind of university professors, and they had a different mentality and a different psychology when it came to teach. I cannot give you a real answer. And I think I don't really trust in one mentor in general, or that person is a mentor, but I trust in a mix of mentors, a mix of interactions, a mix of discussions. And then you can make kind of, you learn something from every person, and you bring together the pieces of the puzzle, and you create a puzzle, your puzzle. And I think if you also ask me, I can make here an analogy with what I think innovation means. I think innovation means is kind of take something on your left, something which from your right, bring them together, shuffle them for three times, and then you create a unique product or unique project. I think that is innovation.
Nice, nice. Nicely said. I'm curious if you would have, I don't know if you have any information or not, if you'd have to do a PhD, for example, at Politehnica University of Bucharest, do you think it would be different than the PhD from Switzerland?
Yeah. In general, I don't badly talk about these things, but I think it's a different level. All right. And again, it's not a different level of knowledge, but it's a different level of approaching a problem, or a different level of being open, or you know. I think it's not really the way, it's not really about the result you got, but maybe the way you got that result.
Right.
I think that's a real difference when it comes to this university here.
All right. I think you've mentioned already, but just to recap, what it meant for you to live and study in Romania, what it meant for you to work and live for this period in the States, and what it means for you to live, work, and study in Switzerland. I think it's quite an interesting mix what you have here. I mean, you cover the East, the West, the. I mean, it's a really nice combination.
I think I kind of placed my basis of knowledge in Romania. Then I managed to learn a lot about market, being business in United States, while in Switzerland, again, I kind of learned how to, let's say, sustainable value my potential. And I think there have been complementary steps. For instance, I'll give you an example. The bachelor level in Switzerland, it's lower than the bachelor level in Romania.
Really?
But the program after bachelor, yeah. The program, and also this is happening in MIT or Stanford. So I think after the bachelor, there is a disaster in Romania, while in different places in the world, I think they treat the problem in the same serious way. But this problem also comes from many other social problems in Romania. Probably you are kind of forced to work because people maybe cannot afford to keep their kids in school for a long time. Even if the school, the education in Romania is free, they kind of forced the kids to go to work. And then even if they could stay another 2 years in academia, they prefer to go to work. So it's really a social problem at the basis of this observation. I can understand the situation.
Right. So tell me, what's your vision when it comes to this technology? In fact, when it comes to travel and the market overall, what do you see in the next 10 years? Or maybe long term, I don't know.
I trust in general, I have a trust in energy autonomous vehicles.
Right.
I don't trust in complicated infrastructures. I trust in interoperability. I trust in efficiency of combining different modes of transportation. And this is happening very well in Switzerland, for instance. I trust in eco rockets. And yeah, I really trust also for long term in hydrogen. But let's say I would have two main visions here. I really trust in energy autonomous vehicles, so things that can also conclude in an interoperable way of transportation. Maybe a car that can fly and get and then go in a hyperloop tube, let's say. So with the same vehicle, you can do the same thing, while you don't have to be connected to any kind of infrastructures. And in the same way, I trust in connectivity of different modes of transportation. So you get out of your home, you take a bus, and then you take a train, and then you take another bus, and then you get into a hyperloop, and then so I trust in interoperability, and I trust in a hyperloop solution. As a third conclusion here, I trust in a hyperloop solution, in an intracontinental hyperloop solution. So I think one of the main competitors in this industry, in the transportation industry, is the airplane and not the train itself. Even if I define hyperloop as being as convenient as a train, as fast as a plane, as convenient as a train, but I think the main competitor here is the airplane itself. But for longer trips, for intercontinental trips, I think it's good to have flights, while for intracontinental flights, I believe more in a hyperloop solution.
Right. What do you need for SwissPod, for example? What top three challenges you have?
I think one of the first challenges we have at SwissPod is a go-to-market. Even if we have a very clear path that's been validated by the Swiss government, I think it still represents the biggest challenge. I think we have one of the best propulsion systems in the world when it comes to high-speed transportation system. I think the second challenge for me as a CEO, for instance, is to keep this team, which is really sustainable, in the same group. So we have around 50 people nowadays.
Congrats.
I think it's a challenge to keep them under the same direction. And another challenge we face, we are kind of decentralized. US, Switzerland, we are US and Europe, let's say. And a challenge might be a bit when you build hardware, when you build infrastructures, when you build benefits at the testing facility level, I think there's a challenge to apply a certain discussion into reality. So I think just to define this by vertically integrating different activities in this value chain of, you know, of the company. So I think this is also another challenge we face nowadays.
So what's your competition, for example? Are they based in Europe or are they based in the States?
I think there are seven hyper companies in this world. Two of them are based in US and the others are based in Europe. But we don't really have a competitors when it comes to our business plan, because our business plan is to develop modular solutions of a capsule. So we want to be a vehicle provider that plays different solutions in different types of infrastructures. But let's say the biggest competitor we have nowadays is Virgin Hyperloop One.
Oh, right.
But in the same time, we closely collaborate with them. So I think at the macro view, we have those competitors. But when it comes to the micro view on the real business plan, I think we're very different from the others. So we're collaborators and we're complementary more than being competitors.
Dennis, I've been watching one of your interviews or one of your previous podcasts, and you've mentioned, I don't know if it's okay to talk about this on the podcast, about maybe an investment coming from Romania, for example. And I want to touch the subject because we both know, for example, the success of UiPath recently, being having the IPO for the New York Stock Exchange last month. What do you think is going to happen also in Romania, in particular in Bucharest and Cluj-Napoca, as we see so many, I mean, I talk with friends, we see what's happening over there in terms of investments, in terms of technology. I'm just curious, what's your point of view on that?
I think the market grows a lot in Romania, and I think it's going to be a great environment. I'm not really up to date of what's going on in Romania in terms of startups, but sometimes I intersect some LinkedIn posts and I'm starting to read. Of course, UiPath, it's another level of company nowadays. And I was really excited to see them successful. And I think they really deserve it. They don't have a comfortable story. I'm in touch with some people from that company, and I think they're really great persons. And I admire them a lot, but I don't really know. I mean, I know some of the person, as you mentioned, were funded by one of the funds in Romania, but I'm not that much aware of what's going on there.
All right, Dennis. Tell me what's one piece of advice you would have to give for younger self or for students out there, coming from a rocket scientist.
That's a very uncomfortable
part-time
question.
PhD and part-time CEO.
That's a very uncomfortable question. I don't know. I've been always uncomfortable to answer for such questions, but I will try to say that I think
You're modest.
Stay humble, to be capable to learn. But more than that, I think while you are open, humble, and eager to learn and to value your potential, I wouldn't have more than that. I think it's enough.
Good stuff. I mean, it's quite nice. I mean, you've accomplished so many things, and yet you have this like mature and modest and humbleness. That's great.
The adventure is just starting. It's just starting now. I think now it starts. So I don't look at it in this way in my past, but I kind of try to see what's going to happen in the future more than looking. I think when you do that, looking at your past, I think you become sufficient with yourself, and you forget maybe to see in the future. So I prefer to do not think about what you mentioned now, and I prefer to just look forward for things to happen.
Healthy mindset, I would say. All right, Dennis, for the listeners out there, just go on SwissPod website and look for t-shirts and jackets. Do you still have jackets? Or?
No, we just have t-shirts, or we have also other options, like you can place your name on the pod. You can buy an invitation for our first event of launching the capsule. You can adopt the VIP pod, or you can plant a tree. So I think there are another four options that you can buy, but yeah, it's kind of a symbolic help, or maybe being part of such an event would be great, because it's going to be the first test in Europe that will ever happen of Hyperloop. So yeah, I think also that can be also a great story.
Right, Dennis. Thanks so much for being so candid on my podcast, and let's leave it to that.
Thanks a lot, Stefan.